Hi, this is Darlene Christensen. I'm the interviewer. Today is October 5th, 2005, and I will be interviewing Delbert Haywood. And one of the areas that I'm most interested in is family structure. Recently, I read an article about Tsimshian society and culture, and it talked about roles, family roles, meaning male, female, your grandparents' roles, kids' roles. It said everybody had a role in society. So I was wondering if you remember any hearing of those things, or what was your role with your family? Maybe you could start off with like your dad's role, your mom's role. And I know in the past you did share some about them, but
mm-hmm.
I'll go ahead and write them.
Well, my mother took care of the house, took care of the kids, which I guess is pretty standard role. My dad was the breadwinner. He worked in and for the kids, they went to school, made sure they did their homework, so they were very adamant about that. Make sure that we attended school, every day.
Your mom's name was what?
Alice
Haywood. And your dad's name was?
Frank.
Do you remember your mom's maiden name or?
Gordon.
Gordon.
No.
Okay. Your grandparents?
Nancy Gordon and Eli Gordon. It's on my mother's side. And my grandfather on my father's side died when I was really young. I don't think any of my brothers and sisters know, but I remember him living in a very small house all by himself. I used to visit him, I used to cut wood for him, things like that. Check on him a lot. And I can't remember his name. His last name was Buxton. My dad's biological father.
B-U-C-K-S.
B-U-X-T-O-N.
B-U-X-T-O-N.
Yeah. I never did know my grandmother. She had died well before we were born.
Would the children, like, did some of their roles also include, like, helping, doing, like, different chores?
Yeah, we did a lot of that. Cleaning the house, and they made sure we did our own rooms, made our own beds.
And that kind of went by subsistence too? When it became fishing time, you guys had to do other things like gathering wood or?
Yeah.
Everything followed your
Yeah, well, when we went out with our grandparents, our parents made sure they said, you help family. He called my grandmother and we called her Na. N-A-H. And B-A-H. Grandfather.
So pretty much like everything was kind of like when it was summer to do fish, you guys helped with that part.
Mm-hmm.
When it was time to gather from the sea, you guys helped with that.
It is mainly done by our grandparents. We worked with them. The commercial aspect of it was done by my dad. So whenever he went out, he would take us, if we were out camping, or my grandparents were out camping, he'd take us to the campsite before he went out on a fishing boat.
Mm-hmm.
It was after my mother passed away, and that's how my grandparents shared in our upbringing.
Another thing that it brought out in the article, well, you know, people write all sorts of different things in history, and one of the things that was kind of interesting was it brought out, it talked about nobles, like in a people class, there's nobles, commoners, and they had slaves. And it said long ago that the nobles were like from the chief's family, commoners were regular people or even related to the chief, and the slaves were usually maybe from war or something like that. You remember hearing any kind of stories like that?
No, I see like, you see, Father Duncan was very successful in wiping out a lot of that. In fact, you mentioned it now. I remember hearing about it on my Clinkett side, you know, that kind of a breakdown of the social structure. I heard of it there, and I've been several times by kids that came from like Hoonah and Angoon and Juneau and those places were predominantly Clinkets, hearing it from them. And we'd hear it, you know, like the Alaska Native Brotherhood, which was predominantly Clinkett. We'd hear while we were in school them mentioning things like that, but never in the sense, yeah. So it may have occurred, you know, while my people were on the Canadian side before Father Duncan intervened. So this is kind of new to me that you mention it, but I would think that the structure would be that way, you know, in the, say, over 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Because I know they did have, as I learned, as our I can't remember the name of it now. Anyway, the way we used to live, or they used to live a long time ago, there was that structure, there was that, everybody knew their position. And I remember them mentioning, like, the uncles did all the training. You know, the kids were disciplined by their uncles, aunts and uncles.
So you kind of heard about that before?
Yeah, that, I remember them, I probably didn't hear about it till maybe I was in high school. We compare notes with kids that were in high school when I was in Sitka. They said, "Oh," and I'd come home and say, "What did we do?" You know, and they said, "Oh yeah, you used to be that way." But then, like I say, Father Duncan. Took that away. We didn't want that to be part of the transformation that we went through.
Yeah.
And so my grandparents, my parents, and myself, my generation, three generations, maybe four, lived without that symptom structure that used to exist.
Okay, when you look back right now as a grown-up, and you think about what kind of things your grandparents and parents instill you, like the values of how to be a person?
Mm-hmm.
Everything
again was based on religion. Of course, there was a division that came after the establishment of New Metropolitan. Based on religion, between two different churches that were there. It was only at that time, as a small boy, there was the Presbyterian Church and then the Church of England, and we used to call it the Big Church. Everybody referred to it as the Big Church. It was Father Duncan's church. In fact, all the political aspects of the community was just like, one was the Presbyterian group, and then the other side was the big church. It was just like the Republicans and Democrats, back then. It's not that way anymore, but yet, because they had a hostile takeover not too long ago. While I was gone, in fact, now the big church, or Father Duncan's church, virtually doesn't exist anymore. I mean, I know, the church that used to be was taken over by I don't know what their denomination is, it's another Christian group. And it's like how businesses take over.
Yeah.
Other smaller business, that's kind of what happened in that case. So, Father Duncan's church lost their position in the community. Founding church in Matagala, Arizona.
When you were growing up, did they, like your parents, or did you hear stories was there a difference, I guess, between what your grandparents tell you in that, when they teach you, they say to be a good person, you have to treat everybody good, you have to respect the land, take care of stuff like that. Did they maybe mix those two with the Christian, or mostly try to forget that side and use only
Christian values?
No,
this kind of like you said, it was mixed. A lot of the values, I guess, that was part of the Sinchan way was incorporated with the church. And but the with the church dominating, because you know we had to go to church every Sunday. We didn't work on Sunday. And we all had to dress up, you know, the Mormon culture suits and women with dresses and with the tie for the men. All in the, probably in the, because I remember that. It was just on the tail end of it, more or less, you know, because it wasn't until our parents' generation came into dominance that they kind of were starting to let go of the church tradition. I mean, they were still there, but yet they weren't the, you know, since Father Duncan died there, that part of the church kind of melted away and took back seat.
Like, for example, of some of the values that you heard before?
They're not practiced anymore. You know, the modern culture took over.
Mm-hmm.
And those values that we had back then, they weren't using anymore.
As a parent right now growing up, and you already raised five kids. Some of the things that you taught them were some of the things that was taught to you?
Yeah, most of the, I would say from my parents and my grandparents, I try to use what I learned from them, but mainly it came from the church. The Presbyterian Church, that, you know, where they treated us in Haines House. A lot of that, I personally try to take the best of each area, you know, if it had anything to do with discipline and things like that. But as far as the aspect of the church, I did not force it on them like it was forced on me. You know, I let them make their own minds up about that. And they did. You know, my daughter is now a member of the, what's her name? You know, in fact, I've got a son and a daughter that remember this,
is it a church here?
Yeah, there's a church here. Their religion is based in the book, the Holy Book, the Holy Bible. But yet its interpretation is different. Jehovah's Witness.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they basically you allowed them to choose what they felt good with.
And it seems to be serving them well. I disagree with a lot of what they, in fact, they try to convert me, especially my son and his wife. He married into that family that was back in there. That's where he got started in it, when he married his wife.
And what about your other kids?
The others haven't chosen anything yet. You know, I don't know whether they will or not, but the values I instilled them, they use.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've had several of them that come back to me and say they thank me for what I did for them. Mm-hmm. my first wife.
Values like respect?
Yeah, respecting other people's space. I guess that's the terminology used.
Yeah.
And other pizza, you know, even other people's religion. And, you know, I don't, you know, ban them from anything.
Yeah.
So let them come to their own conclusions, especially after they grew up. And I told them that. I said, I don't want you to go through what I did, because I didn't think that was right. Because
mm-hmm.
it was just, I felt like it was jammed down my throat. In fact, I ran into a lot of the kids that I went to school with in Haynes House. And I would say almost 100% of those kids, and I mean that's probably 80-90% of the kids that I knew there, don't go to church anymore. You know, for the very same reason. They didn't think. They might have gone to another church, you know, converted over, but most of them just started going on their own, I guess, just like I did.
That's what my dad did too.
Yeah.
He didn't go to church anymore. He never forced us to, but we all gravitated toward our mom's side.
Yeah, that's generally what happened. A lot of them, I would say half-heartedly, even in the influence their parents had them, would say, okay, I'm a Presbyterian, but yet, you know, they're not a, they only practice on Sunday probably, you know, which a lot of kids do, or even parents do nowadays. You know, they're just Christians for one day out of the week. The rest of the week is do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And in most cases, a lot of it's contrary to what the church dictates. So you could say there's a drifting away, you know, the native people are drifting away from a lot of these Christian influences. I see that in the Episcopalian Church, you know, which is what my wife belongs to. But basically, they're still Episcopalians.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I was kind of interested in is maybe if you've heard before or see how the extended family is, for instance. Like we were taught that my sister, girl to girl, their kids are considered like sisters and brothers.
Yeah, you know, first cousins?
Yeah. And the sister and the brother are considered first cousins, but the sister and sister were considered like sisters, sister
mm-hmm.
or brothers.
That I remember that was talked about. It isn't practiced that way anymore, but, you know, I remember my grandparents mentioned that all the first cousins were considered brothers and sisters. We lived that way, you know. There was a lot of my cousins, because of their parents dying when they were small, that my dad and my mother took those kids in, our family. We at one time had 10, 12, 15, you know, people in our house at one time, you know, and they were all consisted of first cousins, even non-related kids, because that's the way the people back home were. You know, no kids were left without a home. I've got two, one is up here, a first cousin. She has she thinks of me as a brother. Because we lived in the same house, and she basically raised us after my mother died. And she was only like...
That's the one you referred to as your older sister one time, or did you...
I've got an older sister. She's younger than I am, but, you know, me being the oldest, but she's my oldest sister in the first family.
Yeah. Okay.
But I've got a first cousin that's older than me by maybe 3-4 years. And she filled the role of my mother after she died, after my mother died. And as far as taking care of the kids, make sure they got to school and things like that. And even today, you know, she's here, she lives here in Fairbanks, and she thinks of me as a younger brother.
Mm-hmm. What about, like your grandparents, or no, your parents' brothers and sisters? Or your grandparents' brothers and sisters? Like my mom and dad, both their parents. In my mom's side, we call them Appa and Grandma because she's Yupik, and in my dad's side, he was from Sweden, so he would have been referred to as Grandpa, or in a Western term. But like in my mom's side, all my Appa's siblings, we were taught to call them all up and grandmas. Like the extended family was close.
Mm-hmm.
How did you refer to your, like your grandma's siblings?
It's like uncles, aunts and uncles. They had a name for them, and the aunts were called, they're actually our grand aunts. We call them Jish. But I forgot what the men were called. And those kind of people had a very strong role in with their nephews and grandnephews and grandnieces. It's not that way anymore, but yet I recall that being that way as a young boy.
Lots of changes.
Yeah,
it's life just breaks, separates, mm-hmm. One part at a time.
Yeah.
You ever got a family tree done yet?
During the Alaskan Claim Settlement Act, they require that we have to check back through our parents to show that that was the way they showed qualification for the being called a native. And you had to have at least quarter blood at the time that settlement was enacted. It was back in the 70s, early 70s. And I had a lot of trouble with that, because at that time they were trying to put everybody in one native corporation. And nobody really fully understood at that time, and when that came about. So there was a lot of shifting around. Since I was up here when it happened, they tried to stick me in the corporation up here.
Doyon.
Then there was again another shift, you know, said, oh, you can't do that. You gotta go back to your, you know, for us to see Alaska. And that's where I finally ended up. And they, what they did is made us members, but we didn't participate as a full-fledged membership. I was a full-fledged member. You know, when they came down and said, okay, you're going to participate in the land settlement. They took that away from us as far as the land. I never got in on the land, nor any of my kids. But we participated in any monetary type settlement, like either on a corporate level or a village level. We'd get full cash settlement. Well, a lot of the people that participated in the land portion, they get a partial cash settlement, and they would get participate in on the village level. You know, it wasn't part of the corporate level, but maybe a village corporate level. But there was a lot of these villages blew their money, you know, that was handed down from the corporate level. You know, when they get their shares. And there was a lot of corruption, you know, that caused that among the... And there was a lot of people that didn't really understand it, you know, and they really didn't have the educational background to know how to handle it. And so a lot of these village-level corporations failed. I don't know if that happened with you, guys, but I remember there's a lot of money that was... was only because of the corruption, and just a handful of people shared in it. Because, you know, of greed.
Yeah.
And so all that money was lost. There's guys that I knew, especially up here on the Doyon. They're still. I know who they are. I'm not going to mention names, but yet I know who they are. They were involved early on in Doyon. Mm-hmm. They ended up, and it was something that I thought would have happened anyway. A lot of guys, you know, they see this great big bunch of money, millions of dollars, you know, and
yeah.
A lot of these then corporate leaders, put in their own pocket.
That's one of the things we bump into with like family services, jurisdiction,
mm-hmm.
area. They say that because of the Land Settlement Act, the claim is that we don't have no more jurisdiction over our land in Scotland. So that's a very live thing today.
Yeah.
And then, so that's why, like Barrow and Chivac, they keep jurisdiction over their land, which is a process they have to do with BIA.
Mm-hmm.
And but a lot of the other village haven't, so they have concurrent jurisdiction with the state,
mm-hmm.
regarding families. And that's
that's what was happening then. That there was a lot of misunderstanding. From the up, right from the top on down, and when they're trying to decide after that settlement act was passed, who's going to take care of all this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think 10 years later, I really didn't know my own position in it. Or my family's position. And so I end up again going back to see Alaska. And since I come from Metlakatla, that was created more complications because that's a reservation, see?
Yeah.
And they can't participate in the Native Claim Settlement Act. So I had to give up that position in Metlakatla in order to be a member of Sea Alaska.
Yeah.
And so that really didn't come, it wasn't settled maybe 10 years after the Alaska Claim Settlement Act. And so because of the long delay and the statute of limitations, I couldn't participate in the land portion of the settlement. So I have no land. I get the cash settlement, you know, whenever it comes about. They'll give me all the cash that I have a right to, but not the land.
Yeah.
And I was very upset about that when it initially was explained to me. You know, I said, "Hey, wait a minute, I can't do this. I want to participate in the land too." So a lot of my grandkids, or my kids and my grandkids, the only way they can participate is when I die, I could will my shares over to them.
Yeah.
Which is what we're doing. But then every now and then I hear something in the wind, you know, hey, we're trying to bring back the land portion of the settlement to be available to those that were, you know, like myself, that were around when that act passed.
Yeah.
They're trying to recover that because they, you know, they realize we had just as much a right to it as all those that, you know, got that right off the bat. But it never did materialize. So that's all I'm participating in, is the cash settlement. You know, we get cash every once in a while, maybe once or twice a year, like $100, a couple hundred dollars. Not in a great amount.
Mm-hmm.
And we get it from Sea Alaska. Now we can participate in the, you know, that deal that was turned over from the BIA to all the different corporations, allowing us to get funding for education. Like it used to be that the BIA handled all that. Well, they turned that function over to the 13 corporations that came out of the Native Claim Settlement Act. And in Sea Alaska, they called the Heritage Foundation. But now I hear that, I'm hearing now that money is running out, so there's really not that much support as far as education in that department of Sea Alaska.
Yeah.
And you have to be right there at the door when that funding comes available, trying to get your name on the list, because you know, they'll just give it to those that have, you know, are there first come, first serve. And if you, and when it runs out for that year, you know, it's every year, there's not enough there to cover everybody that wants to participate in it. It's on a first come, first serve basis. The money to get from the government, you know, was originally handled by the BIA. And they used to have bottomless amount of money for anybody that wanted to participate in it. You know, if where the Claims Act was settled. Now it's drying up.
So you ended up doing a family tree back then?
Yes, it was required. You know, you had a verification from your grandparents. And that took a while. We had to go back on both sides of your family to your grandparents. and it broke it down. That's all it was just a little sketch. We find the tree broken down. You know, just written down on a piece of paper like that.
Yeah.
And you turned it in. That's what they accepted as proof that you have at least quarter blood in you, or whatever tribe you belong to.
So you guys had to talk to lots of people probably to go back, the next generations back.
Yeah, there was a, there was a lot of, I guess, different ways because of different tribes interpreted what the claims that meant, by how they went about coming to a conclusion on verification of the blood in a tribe. There was times that, what you gave me wasn't right, you're going to have to change it. And there was several times that there were several changes, so you could never really settle on it. It took time. It took a lot of time. I said, mine wasn't settled until 10 years after the act was passed. And really, it wasn't, to my satisfaction that it was settled the way they settled it. Because I wanted to participate in the land part of it too. It never ended up that way. Mm. And it was basically because, at first we thought we were going to. We told you to go back to Fairbanks, since I lived here in Fairbanks, was working up here. But they, at that time, they said, Fairbanks doesn't qualify as a village.
Oh, wow.
So they, since I live here, I couldn't, they said, go back to your original village. Well, I couldn't go back to my hotel, because that's not a recognized village when the act was finally settled.
Yeah.
And so they said, okay, select a village right close to Fairbanks. So a lot of people were selecting Minto or Ninanana or things like that. I said, I didn't want to do that. All I did was just say, okay, I'm a member of Sea Alaska, and then I let it lay right there.
When you were growing up, you mentioned a little bit about other kids would stay with you guys, like your extended family. Mm-hmm. If something happened, they took them in, kind of like how, like social service, they try and take that role now and place kids, in extended family or other homes. When that happened, or I don't know if you could remember anything like that happening where the elders or grandparents or your parents took that role and brought the kids in, or there was a specific person.
Well, my mom, or my dad, my mom died, but my dad, even though he married into that family, he took that role. He, without question, he said, okay, I'll take. There was first cousins that he took. And one was a boy and the other two were girls that were my aunts that were part of the Gordon family. And he took that. He took those kids that, all those aunts that died. There was about four or five girls in that Gordon family. And three or four of them died early when we were small. And he took some of them. They spread them out among all the different parts of the family. And he took three of them. My dad did. They lived with us all during the grade school years, until they went to high school. They went to Mount Edgecombe, or they went to Mount Edgecombe, my first cousin who lives up here went to Mount Edgecombe, and my another first cousin, my younger brother, this cousin I have up here, and lived with me. He was like a brother to me. We went all through grade school together, and finally we went separate ways, because he went to Mount Edgecombe and I went to Shell Jackson. And we split up there. But while we were in Sitka, I used to spend most of my time in Mount Edgecombe. And in my weekends, I used to spend with my cousin, because we were close. And I did that all through my high school years.
That was before they had the bridge?
Yeah,
you have to go
a ferry. I used to spend weekends over there, all day, or Saturdays and Sundays, then we had to go back.
I heard there was something like a ferry kind of floating thing, and there was a string from one end to the other end, and they pulled back and forth.
No, there's little power boats. Yeah, they weren't very big. They were like, I would guess 30 feet, but they were all, I would think they were all government vessels, you know, that were formerly used by the military. Yeah, they used those kind of boats. They were little round bottom boats that open, like a large, excuse me, a little cabin on the back end, and everybody stood in the opening. And later on they covered them, you know, a little covering over the top of them, where the passengers stood in the rear, but you're still out in the open because there's no sides, just the top. So if it was raining or windy, you were exposed to the elements.
Yeah.
But that was just a little short ride.
Yeah.
You know, and it was every half hour. You know, we had two or three boats going at once. Because there was a lot of kids back then, you know, 800-900 kids in my classroom at the time. And a lot of staff, yeah. And you had the hospital there, so there was a lot of activity of traffic that had to be taken care of by the ferry system. So they were going every half hour. So when we went to, those kids that got passes to go to Sitka, you know, so they could shop and things like that. They visit friends, they could do it. And they had there was a ferry that they had, that the Mount Edgecombe kids had to get like the 8 o'clock ferry at the latest coming back to the Mount Edgecombe side. Same way with us, and we had to get the ferry to make sure we got home before 8. You know, to Miss J.
Okay, one more thing I was kind of interested in is growing up, did you remember any kind of ways that you were taught to deal with grief, or by then was there it was already combined with Christianity? Like for instance, in Kalskag, like my appa, his dad, when his sister died, my great-appa's sister died, the way they kind of dealt with it was they named a hill after her name, so they would say her name so you get through the grief, you don't forget and stuff like that. You remember anything like that?
No, I don't. Like I say, my mother died, I would say, I remember them, they used to take pictures all the time, you know, the body laying on and waiting in the house. They used to put the body on the table. Before they got the casket, and that's where we'd wait until they got the casket in.
Yeah.
It was like a table, they put on a table right in the living room, and that stayed there, the body stayed there. I remember my mother being on that table in the house for a couple of days before they, until they got the casket, because it took a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to go to Ketchikan to get a casket. See, up here they built caskets. I guess they probably did that where you come from. Yeah, well, they do that in Minto. I've been, because of my carpentry skills, I participated in building a lot of caskets up here. Down home, my dad did that for a long time, but later on, people could afford commercial type built caskets.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what they did for my mother. They ordered one from Ketchikan and they sent it our way. You know, they do all that kind of stuff, you know. In fact, they send the body to Ketchikan to have it, whatever they do for the body, you know, before they put it in the casket.
Yeah.
I don't know what they do. I heard that they would take, inject the body with some kind of a fluid to so they
take the blood out. So
that, yeah, that, yeah,
so
right. That sort of thing. I don't know if that's true or not, but I hear that, you know. Because I remember they used to ship the body to Ketchikan and come back in a casket. And it would be over there for a day or two. Embalming and stuff like that. You know.
At that time, did they sing traditional songs yet? Or it was
no.
All...
No, it was just all just Presbyterian church, you know. We'd have a service in the church, maybe twice, you know, before that. We'd have a service in the evening, and then at the day of the burial, they'd take the body in prayer all over through town on a pickup or, And they still do that today. I remember as a little boy they had a special cart. Before they had cars back home, they had a little cart that they put the coffin on, just a two-wheel cart with a balancing wheel on the ends. Paraded through town just before they had roads, they used to have boardwalks. And they'd parade the body and they'd have people following, you know, in a parade.
Mm-hmm.
People following. But like I said, back then they used to take pictures all the time in the house and in the parade. And everybody dresses up and finally they'd take it down. Graveyard. It was about a half mile, maybe a mile out of town.
Was it like a how many day procession?
How many days? It was just the day of the burial, the procession. But they kept the body initially in the house, and they moved to the church for the evening service. And during the, you know, they'd have visitation things, you know. That they did, you know, allow them to come in and allow everybody to say goodbye to them for the last time that evening. And the next day they'd have the actual burial service in the church. And then when we took the body down to, they'd have a short service down there, you know, at the actual burial site. And the burial will take place. Actually, the burial was just putting the body in the grave, and then just everybody throwing a handful of dirt in there, and then that was the end of the service, and everybody would leave, and they'd have a group of guys that did the actual burying, you know, after the service. But I know in Minto they don't do that. Everything is done right. And everybody stays right there. you know, all the guys would participate in that actual area of the covenant, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, so we kind of went through lots of different things all the way to grief.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look back as a child, what was one of your favorite things that you enjoyed doing as a little boy?
Fishing, I guess, is one of the memorable things, is fishing around in the bay right there in Little Cala. There was a lot of fishing streams there, and we knew every one of them. Another one was grouse hunting. We did a lot of that. We just, I don't know why the parents let us go, but we'd go out in the woods all by ourselves, you know, with a friend or somebody, go grouse hunting.
What you guys kill them at? 22s?
Yeah, 22s. We all had guns when we were kids. 22s, shotguns. I had my first high-powered rifle when I was 16. It allowed me to go deer hunting, you know. I'm a big game hunter like that.
Okay, well, thank you for all your input,
mm-hmm.
and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.